for the benefit of our visitors this evening, I want to explain that occasionally a sermon is devoted to questions that have been submitted by the members. There's a box outside the auditorium on the right-hand side as you're leaving where you can write down a question, signing it with your name, and then out of those questions, typically I will answer some questions. Not all the questions get answered publicly. Some of them are of a nature that they're best answered privately. That's one of the reasons that I encourage you to write your names on the questions so that I'm aware of who it is that I need to contact if for some reason I would prefer to answer the question privately as opposed to publicly. Also, occasionally, I get questions that I'm not sure I understand or I would like a little bit of clarification on, and sometimes they're anonymous and I really can't get any kind of clarification if I don't know who it is that is writing the question. Now, questioners are not identified publicly. You will not be finding your name held up before the congregation for any question that you ask. I get several different kinds of questions. Some of the questions I get are basically information questions, and the answers just need to be dug out of the facts that are contained in the Scriptures. Those are the easy questions, frankly. There are other questions that are application questions, and what they require is the application of either facts or principles from the Scriptures to various circumstances or situations that we encounter. And all of us have to do that. And so I think it's good practice for us to take the Scriptures and try to make that application to some sort of concrete circumstances. And then occasionally I get a question that falls into the third type. Those are the unanswerable questions. There is no answer for those questions. The Lord didn't tell us. And I'll not presume to step in where He hasn't spoken and try to answer the question for you. I really have no illusions about being infallible in my answers. This is the 21st sermon of this type, which means we've answered a boatload of questions. And I dare say there have been some answers that you haven't agreed with. I was always right. I'm just kidding you. That's my very point. I'm not always right. From time to time, I change my own view about things as I come to, hopefully, a better understanding of principles and information that are contained in the Scriptures. And you, as you grow, will do the same thing. And so I don't have any illusion about being infallible. What I do is I research the questions to the best of my ability and knowledge, and then I present the answer that I believe is consistent with Scripture. You may not agree with the application of some of the principles that I employ in these answers, and that's fine. I understand that. Hopefully, we can benefit anyway from our common study. Now, tonight, there are several questions that I have selected on various subjects. These are some of the subjects that we'll be discussing. Bankruptcy, the Jewish attitude toward Jesus, the multitudes who surrounded Jesus. We're going to deal a little bit with predestination and foreknowledge this evening. I have a question about interactive worship. Another question about the origin of the races, miraculous spiritual gift of faith, and business solicitation at services. The idea of somebody coming to worship services and asking you to buy something or to support a fundraiser or something of that nature. Now, the elders, for their own curiosity, ask me occasionally to send these questions to them ahead of time. And so I did that this week. And I've noticed several of them have brought pillows tonight. But fear not. I came to my senses as I began preparing the answers to these questions and realized there wasn't any way we were going to cover all that stuff. And so what I'm going to attempt to do is cover the first five subjects, and we may not even get all of those done. But those of you who asked the last two questions, I will get to you. It's just going to have to wait till the next sermon. We have a lot on the menu this evening, so let's begin by talking a little bit about the first question. Is it sinful for a Christian to declare bankruptcy? I am not an authority on bankruptcy law. I'm not an authority on any law, any man-made law. But I now know more about bankruptcy than I ever really wanted to know. I want to share some of that with you. Bankruptcy, by definition, is a legally declared inability or impairment of ability of an individual or a corporation to pay their creditors. When you can't pay your debts, can't pay your bills, then what happens is you are legally declared bankrupt. There's some general information that we really do need to observe as we talk about the specific question, is it sinful for a Christian to declare bankruptcy? And first of all, there are different kinds of bankruptcies. Most of you are probably aware of that. There's a bankruptcy that is known as Chapter 7. It's just named after the chapter in the law code or the civil code that deals with bankruptcies. There are several different chapters. As I recall, there's a Chapter 12, a Chapter 13, and I think maybe even a couple others. Chapter 7 bankruptcy is the most common form of bankruptcy. And what happens is all of the non-exempt property of the debtor. There are some things that the government or the courts will not come in and seize and sell, but the rest of your property is sold by a trustee who then takes the proceeds and divides them among the various creditors that you have. Now, there are other forms of bankruptcy that will allow you to retain some sort of income-producing assets with the plan for the gradual amortization of debt. What it means is that they just kind of spread your debt out over a longer time. You have to present the court with a plan for how you're going to take care of your debts, and they're going to oversee that, but they don't seize all of your property. It is important for us to understand another fact, and that is that bankruptcy actually can happen in a couple of ways. You can declare bankruptcy if you are the debtor, or it may be that your creditor comes and charges you or places you in bankruptcy, and that's involuntary. You don't have anything to say about that. And so depending on the circumstances, you may or may not have been the one to pursue the bankruptcy proceedings. Now, and this is important. In bankruptcy, if there are not sufficient assets to satisfy the various debts or creditors, some debts may end up being discharged. So here I owe this company or that company, or I've bought something on credit, and I declare bankruptcy, and they seize all my assets, non-exempt property, and they sell that, and they give it to the creditor, and there's still not enough to go around. In some bankruptcies, and with some debts, those debts end up being canceled, even though they haven't been paid in full. Now, sometimes we are suspicious, perhaps, that what individuals do is they run up bills that they are not going to be able to pay. And then they declare bankruptcy to escape their bills. Or in some cases, individuals have bills or financial obligations, and they really do have the cash to pay their creditors. They just choose not to. They instead declare bankruptcy. That is a crime. It's called bankruptcy fraud. And if it can be determined that the filing for bankruptcy was with the intention of evading payment for goods that you've received, or to accept payment for goods without providing the service or the goods that you have received payment for, you can be charged with a crime for that form of behavior, that bankruptcy. Now the premise that's, or I should say the passage that is probably most often used to answer this question, is it sinful for a Christian to declare bankruptcy, is a passage in the book of Romans in chapter 13 and verse 8. Where the Apostle Paul instructs us to owe no one anything except to love one another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. You may never have heard this view, but there are some people who believe that this verse actually teaches that we really shouldn't engage in any kind of purchase by credit. Because when we do so, we end up owing somebody. We ought to be debt-free, is the interpretation sometimes placed in this verse. I do not believe that this verse is forbidding installment credit, and I'll tell you why. I have a contract with a mortgage company. And the contract with that mortgage company is that they lent me a certain amount of money. And my obligation is to amortize that debt, that amount of money, over a period of years, 30 in my case. And every month I am obligated by contract to pay a certain amount of money. And when I pay that money, I don't owe them anything else. I have satisfied that contract. I'm not in a constant state of owing money because of the contract that I have made with them. And so as long as I make my payments as they're stipulated by contract, I don't owe these creditors. I have fulfilled my obligations, which I think is Paul's point here about owing, and that is the fulfillment of obligations. May I suggest to you that it's kind of easy to conclude that bankruptcy is sinful because it is the failure to pay one's debts. And those debts are almost always, in our society, secured by some sort of written promise to pay. When was the last time you went to the car dealer and you said, I'd like to buy a car, and the guy says, I'm sorry, what's your name? And I say, I'm Alan Dvorak. He says, oh, I know your father, Stanley Dvorak. Here, which car do you want? And they just let me drive off because I said as I was driving off, waving through the window, I'll pay you. No, you have to sign contracts. And your promise, your written promise is to pay back the amount or to pay the amount for that car if you are buying it on credit. And so it's pretty easy to say, well, you made a promise to pay. Bankruptcy is a failure to pay. Therefore, it's sinful. But I want to bring something else to your attention that maybe we ought to think about. There are a variety of reasons for which one of us might not be able to pay our debts. True, it may be that we are just unwilling to pay debts or to fulfill promises that we've made. That's wrong. That's inappropriate for any Christian. But I'll tell you, there are some other reasons. And we ought to be cautious maybe about judging others. I've become more cautious about that because you can become unable to pay your debts for a variety of reasons. For instance, the loss of income. You lose your job. You don't control that. And you may not be able to secure another job which will allow you immediately to handle the debt load or the cost of living that you've assumed. You might have to change jobs. Occasionally companies downsize and they'll move you from one job at one pay scale to another job at a lesser pay scale, and it happens pretty quickly. And it's difficult to pay debts that you have been accustomed to paying. Or sometimes we just get sick. And for an extended period of time, we can't work. We may or may not have any kind of regular salary coming in. And all of a sudden, we find ourselves unable to pay debts through things that really are not our own fault. There are sometimes extraordinary expenses that are necessary and, again, not controlled by us. You can come down with some sort of a medical condition that could run up thousands and thousands of dollars of bills, and all of a sudden you have a debt that you did not you didn't pursue this. It's not consumer credit, but you've got to pay that debt, and it's just very difficult for you to do on the salary or with the assets that you have. Your house could burn down, or it could be flooded. This is a depressing sermon. But these things happen to people sometimes. And it's foolish for us to think that it would never happen to any of us, because sometimes it does. Now, I would, of course, admit there are times when people use credit unwisely. And that's sometimes the reason they can't pay their debt, because they have tried to live at a certain level that really their income will not sustain. And credit's too easily available, obviously, in our country. That use of credit Americans are notorious for high credit card debt. Let me give you my answer to this. You're not going to like this. I'm not going to argue that bankruptcy is always sinful, but that conclusion really depends on circumstances. It depends on what kind of decisions people have made and the reasons that they've made them. If someone says, well, I'm just going to buy, and I'm going to get all kinds of things for myself, and then they find themselves unable to pay their debts, then their bankruptcy is essentially the result of a lack of self-control. And when you promise to pay with no intention of paying in some cases, that's dishonesty. That's deception. And that is wrong, and that would be sinful. But I've also come to realize that there are a whole lot of us that, if the truth be told, if for some reason all of a sudden we didn't have income for a month or even a couple of weeks, we'd be in a world of trouble. How would we pay our bills? There are a lot of people, Americans in general, and I don't know about the congregation here, but there are a lot of Americans who live right on the edge of bankruptcy, or the inability to pay their debts. And so I think we need to be careful about judging what happens or the cause for somebody's bankruptcy. And so I'll leave the question with that and go on to the next question. This next question has to do with the attitude of the Jewish common people toward Jesus. Here's the question. How do you explain the change in the attitude of the Jewish people toward Jesus at the time of his crucifixion as opposed to most of the time throughout his ministry? The Jewish leaders, it is stated, were afraid to kill him because they feared the people. So what changed, and how seemingly very quickly? Jesus, of course, was extremely popular, I think, throughout his public ministry. When he is in the midst of his Galilean ministry, there are numerous passages in the Gospels that suggest that he was thronged by multitudes of people to the extent that occasionally he had to go way out into a deserted place to find any privacy so that he himself could pray to the Father. And I'm going to just suggest a few example passages. We could multiply them, of course. In Matthew, the 4th chapter, verses 23 and 24, his fame went throughout all Syria, verse 24. Here are people coming from everywhere, thronging Jesus. In Matthew 13, 1 and 2, the multitudes are gathered together, and they're so numerous, the people here, that Jesus goes offshore and sits in a boat to teach the people in that chapter of parables in Matthew 13. Another passage in Matthew, the 15th chapter, great multitudes came to Jesus, having with them the lame, the blind, mute, maimed, and many others. And they laid them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. So the multitude marveled when they saw the mute speaking, etc., and they glorified the God of Israel. So people came from all over to throng Jesus. They were interested in him. They were intrigued by him. Now, there were some times when Jesus said some things that I think turned people off. And I'm persuaded, as I suggested a few weeks ago in a sermon entitled Culling the Flock, that there were times when Jesus tested the commitment of the disciples. John 6 is a good example of that. Verses 66 says that following his discussion in John 6, there were people who apparently were following just because they could eat of the food that he was multiplying miraculously, and they stopped following him. But don't misunderstand that, because when Jesus comes to Jerusalem for the last time, he is surrounded by multitudes of people who are essentially heralding him as the Messiah. Matthew, the 21st chapter, you see that in verses 1 through 11. In fact, I would tell you that I believe Jesus' popularity is the very reason that the Jewish leaders plotted to arrest Jesus. And they wanted to do it privately. Because to do it publicly would stir up such a public commotion that they weren't sure perhaps how that would go. They feared the multitudes. A number of passages tell us. Matthew, the 26th chapter, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people have assembled at the palace of the high priest, at Caiaphas's palace, and they plot to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. But now listen, here's the stipulation. Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people. Now, statements like that make me think that Jesus was still very popular with the common people, or else the rulers, the leaders of the Jewish people, wouldn't have to dance around behind the scenes to try to take Jesus to arrest him. They wouldn't have to worry about whether it was the Passover or not. Mark, the 11th chapter, verse 18, the scribes and chief priests heard it, and they sought how they might destroy him, for they feared him, because all the people were astonished at his teaching. They were afraid of him, but they were also envious of him. They feared the multitudes, and so they were unable to lay hands on him, as the scriptures say in Matthew 21, because of the multitudes. Luke 19, in the last week of Jesus' life, he's teaching daily in the temple, and the chief priests, the scribes, and the leaders, they want to destroy him and were unable to do anything, for all the people were very attentive to hear him. So Jesus' popularity was not just a function of the Galilean ministry, not just the beginning of his public ministry. It continued even into the last week of his life. Crowds are thronging him as he enters Jerusalem before and behind. They're laying down their garments. And as he teaches in the temple daily, the people are thronging, so much so that the leaders of the Jews are afraid to touch him for fear of what might happen with the crowds. They were envious of Jesus. We've already looked at Mark, the 11th chapter, verse 18, but now look at Mark 15, verse 10. Pilate knew that the chief priests had handed Jesus over because of envy. Everybody was listening to Jesus. Everybody was wanting to follow Jesus. And as leaders of the people, the Jewish leaders were envious of that kind of popularity. And the popularity of Jesus determined several events. Let me give you a couple of illustrations. The betrayal of by Judas was not that Judas had some secret knowledge or whatever, except that he knew where Jesus could be taken in private. In Luke chapter 22 and verse 6, notice, the idea is to go and take Jesus in a spot where the crowds are not going to be. He was arrested at night, as opposed to during the day when he was in the city teaching the people. And even the night trial of Jesus, which was essentially illegal under Jewish traditional law, but it's done at night because that way you can railroad Jesus right through the judicial process and thus condemn him before people really even know what's going on. And so the whole thing, from the betrayal to the condemnation to the turning Jesus over into the hands of the Romans, all took place in a matter of hours and all under the cover of darkness. And I would suggest to you that that would be unnecessary if in fact common public opinion had turned against Jesus. Neither the clandestine arrest nor the night trial would have been necessary under those circumstances. So how do we reconcile this information where the crowds are following Jesus and he's so popular, and then you've got a crowd who stands before Pilate and Pilate's trying to release Jesus and they cry out for Barabbas, and what shall I do with Jesus, he asked, and they say, crucify him. Why? What evil has he done? Well, he said he was a king. Who were those people and why did things change so quickly? My answer is that although I used to believe that what had happened was the crowd had become fickle and they changed their opinion, I'm not so sure that's the truth. I think we're looking at two different multitudes. I think the common people, even in the last week of Jesus' life, they were interested in supporting him. They declared him the Messiah. They were listening to his teaching. But there was a different group of people who'd been assembled by the Jewish leaders on the morning of his trial before Pilate. And those people were influenced by the chief priests and the rulers, who encouraged them to deny Jesus, to request Barabbas, and to ask for the crucifixion of Jesus. Two different multitudes. Not so much a change in the general opinion about Jesus. The next subject actually is a compilation or combination of two questions. These are the questions I received. The quotation marks indicate that I'm giving you to them, them to you exactly as I received them. Did God foresee Satan turn evil? Well, that's an interesting question. Does God know, a separate question, what's going to happen in the future down to every small detail? We know from the Bible that His will shall be done and that He gave Old Testament prophets truthful foretellings of future events. On the flip side, here's somebody who's been listening to my sermons too much, we see in Numbers 14 how Moses changed the plan of God to destroy the Israelites. In 1 Samuel 15, we see how God later lamented over His choice to make Saul king of Israel. Does God really know every action and choice that I will make in life? If so, listen, if so, then predestination is probably a valid doctrine. So which way is it? All-knowing or not? I guess I've been given a multiple choice question here. I'll have to choose. Well, let me just make a couple of observations in the very beginning. And that is that both divine foreknowledge and divine predestination are biblical concepts. And I would encourage you to turn in your Bibles to the second chapter of Acts, into the very first gospel sermon recorded for us in chapter 2 and verse 22. Here's how it starts with the Apostle Peter. Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs which God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves also know. Him being delivered by the determined purpose and foreknowledge of God, you have taken by lawless hands, have crucified and put to death. Peter affirms that God does know things before, that divine foreknowledge is a true concept. We could turn over to Romans the 8th chapter, verse 29, where Paul very clearly says that God did predestine certain things to happen. The question is, what how do we understand these doctrines, and particularly the doctrine of predestination? I want to suggest to you there is a very definite conflict between the popular view of predestination, and that view is essentially that no matter what Greg Keel does the rest of this week, God's already foreordained, determined, controlled what it's going to be. And so as he goes to work, whatever decisions he makes there, God's already decided that. Doesn't make any difference what Greg wants to do. God's going to mold it so that Greg only does what God has determined he should do. He will do. God controls everything. That is a popular view of predestination. But there's a definite conflict between that view and the biblical doctrine of man's free moral choice. If a man sins, is it because of his free choice, his ability to choose evil or good, or is it God's decision about what will happen? And some people will answer, yes. That somehow free moral choice is not negated or limited by God determining everything that you will do. And I don't know how you can come to that conclusion. If I have the option, the true choice, to go this path or that path, if God determines I'm going to go that path, what if I wanted to choose that path? You see my point? There's a conflict between those two doctrines. And if I decide to take the wrong path, whose fault is it? Is it my fault or is it God's fault? After all, if He predestined that I take that path, how in the world can He hold me accountable for going the wrong way? He chose, not my choice. You see, conflict between the popular view of predestination and the biblical view of man's ability to choose right or wrong. Someone says, well, where do you get that doctrine? Every passage that invites me to choose asserts that I have the right to choose. If God has already predetermined, predestined, whether I'm going to beat my wife later this day, my wife's just perked up at this point in the sermon, then I don't have any choice in the matter. I'm just a robot. You're as good as beaten, if that's the way it's been determined by God. I'm not responsible for that. If God condemns me for doing what He has already determined, predestined that I will do, then can He be a just God if He condemns me for doing what He made me do? At the risk of being foolish or facetious, if you make your child do something and then turn around and spank them for doing what you just told them they have to do, are you really a good parent? Are you a fair parent? Is that just? I have serious problems with this business of the popular view of predestination that God has determined everything that's going to happen. Fulfilled prophecy really does necessitate at least the concept of divine foreknowledge. And what I mean by that is that in order for anybody to accurately predict the future, you have to be able to see what's going to happen. That's the minimum that we really need to accept, and there may be more involved. I believe that there's a difference between foreknowledge and predestination. There's a difference between knowing something that will happen before it happens and predetermining that it will happen. And I'll illustrate that in just a few moments. But to know something will happen before it happens does not necessarily imply control. But predestination, according to the common view, speaks of determining something ahead of time. In fact, that's really the meaning of predestination, regardless of how you view it as applying to God. Now, there's a thing that was said in this question that I want to revisit. Here's the comment that was made. Does God really know every action and choice that I will make in life? If so, now listen to the conclusion. If so, if God knows every choice I'm going to make, then predestination is probably a valid doctrine. And my point is, knowing and determining are two different things. And you can know something's going to happen, but that doesn't mean that you necessarily determine it. Foreknowledge and predestination are two different concepts. And while both are true of God, the popular view of predestination is not. I believe that the conclusion that is in this question is an invalid conclusion. I believe that God can know, He can anticipate the decisions that I'll make in any particular situation. He knows whether I'm going to beat my wife or not if He chooses to this week. Let me restate that. If He chooses to, He knows that I will beat my wife this week. That's a little clearer. But that's not the same thing as mandating that I have to make that decision. That's predestination. Does God have to know everything that 'll happen in the future? Think about this for just a moment. Can He choose not to know something? Somebody said no. Well, let me give you an illustration of that. Some of you have even had this experience. Modern technology, medical technology, will allow you to determine the sex of your infant before that child is born. You can go in for the sonogram, and the doctor will say, oh yes, it's going to be a boy. Now, about half the time he's wrong, and it'll be a girl anyway, but for the moment, bear with me, and let's just affirm that if you want to know, you can know. But I know some of you who don't want to know before the child is born. And you have the power to know. You have the ability to know. And you choose not to know. Why? Well, I don't care why. The point is, you chose not to know. God has the power to know. He is God, all-knowing. Can He choose not to know? Well, I think it's possible. I'm not sure I can come up with a good illustration of that situation. But I would like to illustrate something else about God's working in the future. And it has to do with Judas. Judas is an enigma. Old Testament prophecy foretold that one of the disciples would betray Jesus. And Judas was that disciple. Now the question we need to answer is, did Judas have a choice? Was Judas just a robot? And here he is condemned for betraying his own master, but it had been decreed by God that he would do it. Is that what happened? Did God force Judas to do that? Or is it a case of God in the past looking forward to the future and knowing the heart of Judas before Judas was ever born, anticipating a choice that Judas would make? And if you'll permit me, I'll throw another wrench into the works. Why in the world did Jesus choose Judas as a disciple? Did He know nothing about Judas? Did Jesus not anticipate anything about the character of Judas? Come now. I think He knew exactly what kind of person Judas was. He knew the hearts of men on several occasions. He knows what they're thinking without them even saying it. Does He know about the character of the heart of Judas? Yes, that's why He chose such a man. And the opportunity was there. And still, Judas has the choice. What are you going to do, Judas? You going to betray Jesus or not? Free will. And yet God looking forward and anticipating the choice that Judas might make in the free will situation. I think it's clear from the Scriptures that God does work in the affairs of men to bring about His purpose. He not only foreknows some things, He also works to accomplish His purpose. And I'll give you two illustrations of that. One is Pharaoh. The comment is made over in Exodus the 9th chapter, verse 16, that God raised up Pharaoh for the very purpose of demonstrating His power. I believe God put on the throne in Egypt a man whom He knew when faced with certain choices would reject those choices, would reject the good, and God would have the opportunity to bring the plagues on a rebellious nation, I'm talking about Egypt now, and show another nation His power also, I'm talking about Israel now. I believe God also in the betrayal of Jesus, as I've already suggested by the selection of Judas to be one of the disciples, I believe God not only foreknew what was going to happen, but in a sense He prepared it. He certainly presented the opportunity for Judas to betray Jesus, depending or as a result of Judas's character. Let me give you my answer on this. I believe that God must at least be able to know the future in order to reveal prophecy that's going to ultimately be fulfilled without error. I also believe that at times God worked in the affairs of men, as in the case of Pharaoh or in the case of Judas. But I don't believe that either action, either foreknowing or the working of God, interfered with the free will of man. And I also believe that God can choose not to know certain details of the future. I'm not sure I can prove that. It does seem to me that God would have had the capacity to foresee the fall of Satan. That was one of the questions that was asked. I don't know if he chose to see it or not. I don't know that the scriptures tell us that. That's one of those questions in the unanswerable category, as far as I can tell. Let me deal with the next question. We may not get to the final question. Do you get a sense that the New Testament worship was more interactive, with members asking questions of the teacher in an orderly fashion, which is not what we traditionally do today? And you know that I do the talking, you do the listening, until we get into the lobby in which you can tell me what a fine sermon I've preached. But up until then, I do all the talking, and you don't get an opportunity to ask questions. Should we scripturally allow opportunity for questions, since it appears they were allowed in 1 Corinthians 14 by other people except for your women? Well, 1 Corinthians 14, I kind of scan my memory. As near as I can determine, 1 Corinthians 14 is virtually the only passage that gives us specific details about a worship assembly. And those regulations, that information was in the context of the exercise of miraculous spiritual gifts. And yet there are some other things said in that chapter about the way that a worship assembly should proceed that are of general application even to our assemblies. That's the point of the questioner. Now there are other passages that give us details about acts of worship, but in terms of an assembly, 1 Corinthians 14 is virtually the only passage that gives us these kinds of specific details. And there are two verses there that seem particularly relevant to the question that is being asked here. And they are verses 34 and 35. In verse 34, the scripture reads, "Let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive, as the law also says." And so verse 34 forbids women to speak in the churches. The issue does not seem to be sound. It seems to be submission, as the latter part of the verse indicates. But they are, in contrast, they are to be submissive, as the law also says. Verse 35, "And if they want to learn something, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is shameful for women to speak in church." Now the question that often comes up is, who are these women? Who are we talking about here? And there are about three different suggestions that I have noted that I'm aware of. Some people believe it was women with miraculous spiritual gifts. We know that some women did exercise miraculous spiritual gifts, and some people think that these are the women under consideration. Others believe that it is specifically the wives of the prophets, those who were doing the speaking, or for that matter, the tongue speakers, and their wives were interrupting them to ask questions. And what Paul's saying is, if you got questions asked, you ask at home. You don't disrupt the assembly in order to do that. There are others, including myself, who believe that it's talking about all the women in the assembly, that submission is a responsibility and obligation that falls equally upon all the women in this particular assembly or any assembly. I do not believe, and this is important, I don't believe that it is necessarily implied that there were others who were asking questions, or even that the practice was approved as long as women didn't participate. That's an assumption. All we know is that apparently there were some women who were doing that, and they were forbidden to do that. We don't know from this passage that anybody else was doing. That is an assumption. And it may not be a correct assumption under the circumstances. We just don't know. It seems likely to me that Paul is addressing a problem with women who are causing some sort of confusion or disorderliness by interrupting the speakers with their questions. And they are encouraged not to take on any kind of a leading role or to cause disorderliness or confusion. Let me make this observation to you. With some restrictions, and we're looking at one here in verse 34 and 35, we have some liberty in the way that we conduct our worship, do we not? We can choose how many songs we want to sing. In fact, we don't necessarily have to sing as a collective group every time we come together. I know that's heresy. But the fact of the matter is, we're not obligated by Scripture to do that. We need to do it at some point, but not necessarily every assembly. We don't have to have a sermon twice on Sundays. Did I say that out loud? And so we have some liberty. We can observe the Lord's Supper at the beginning or the end of the service. Now, there are some specific patterns that we do need to follow. We're given information regarding the Lord's Supper. We're given some information regarding our giving or the way that the church funds its work. But as long as we operate within the realm of that revealed information, of those patterns, there's still some liberty, some judgment that needs to be exercised, can be exercised in our worship. One of the general principles that guides our assemblies is orderliness and decorum. And I find it interesting that in 1 Corinthians 14, this is the passage that we've been looking at, there are numerous references to that very point. The idea of edification being the objective of this particular assembly under consideration in chapter 14. Look, for instance, at verse 5. I wish you all spoke with tongues, but even more that you prophesied. For he who prophesies is greater than he who speaks with tongues, unless indeed he interprets, that the church may receive edification. In fact, Paul just boils it down. He says, listen, you've got to choose between prophecy and tongues. Choose prophecy because it brings edification, and that's really what you're after. Look at verse 12 here. Even so you, since you are zealous for spiritual gifts, let it be for the edification of the church that you seek to excel. Verse 26, the end of the verse, let all things be done for edification. Verse 31, for you can all prophesy one by one that all may learn and all may be encouraged. That's what's involved in edification. For God's not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. God's not the author of disorderliness and confusion. Let all things be done decently and in order, he concludes in verse 40. And so I would suggest to you, in my answer, that I don't get the sense that the New Testament worship was more interactive with members asking questions of the teacher. However, I also believe that we could arrange opportunities for members to ask questions at the end of a sermon, providing that we do not violate any of the specific guidelines or general principles that are set out in the Scriptures. And obviously the most striking one is the submission of women to men. Well, I got one more question. And I'm going to share the question with you, but I'm not giving you the answer. I'm going to wait till the next sermon, and we'll talk about the answer in the next sermon. But this is a fascinating question. If everyone came from two people, Adam and Eve, how did we get all the races we have today? If it was at the Tower of Babel, did people automatically become African American, black, Caucasian, Chinese, etc.? Let me tell you, to answer that question, we're going to talk about the Tower of Babel. We're going to talk about Gregor Mendel. We're going to talk about garden peas of the tall variety and the short variety. We're going to talk about the Ephraimites and Shibboleth versus Sibboleth. We got a lot of things to say about that question, but not today, because our time is up. I appreciate so much your kind attention. I always feel a little bit disoriented when I do these kind of sermons. We're just jumping from subject to subject. But the common theme of, if there is a common theme in this sermon, is that you ask the questions and I'm trying to give you the answer. Greg picked a song that suggests there's coming a time when you'll have to give an answer, even as I will, to God for what kind of life we've lived. The answer, essentially, is whether or not Jesus is our Savior. Whether we've obeyed the gospel, whether we've been forgiven our sins, whether we've been pronounced righteous, not by our own goodness or efforts, merit, but by the blood of Jesus Christ, cleansed by the grace of God, and by His favor, pronounced righteous. Will that be your answer? My answer is Jesus Christ died for me. And on the basis of His blood, I've been forgiven. That's God's promise. Can you give that answer on the day of judgment? If you need to respond to the gospel this evening by becoming a child of God, by beginning a new life, coming out of the waters of baptism free and clean from the stain of sin, no more guilt, then why not tonight, as we stand and sing, to invite you?